Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hello, my wonderful audience. I have a genuine ginger news flash for you. Great news. Justina Pelletier has been released and is going home after 16 months of psychiatric abuse at the Boston Children's Hospital and under their governance. Justina, most of you probably know, was a youngster, 16 years old, being treated for mitochondrial disease, which is a metabolic disorder. It's recognized by the establishment. It's not some far out, unproven problem. She was being treated for this, was doing well at Tufts, and one of her doctors, a GI guy, moved on to the Boston Children's Hospital. And so they went there to visit him. They went through the ER. They were seized by psychiatry. She was made an involuntary patient and was declared to have a psychological disorder, somatoform disorder. That means you're making it up on some level. And that her parents were colluding with this. They cut her off from her parents. And over a period of weeks, she went from being a vibrant young woman, able to skate and play and have a life, to an invalid at the hands of this Boston City Hospital, Children's Hospital. A violent fight broke out between the hospital, who wanted to seize and hold her, and her parents, who wanted her back. The violence was not on the parents' side. It was wholly on the side of the hospital and the courts. Courts love colluding with psychiatrists. It's kind of a coalition of authority and will tell you how to live your lives. Well, there's been a huge outcry, and she has now been returned home. Justina Pelletier is free. What a great news flash. Now for something not, and that's, you know, I call these my ginger news flashes because she's the one who connects a lot to the web. And this one, she literally handed to me as I headed in today to the microphone in the office where I have my little office surrounded by my microphone, my high-tech mic. And, you know, I'm on Skype here and on instant messaging with PRN and my engineer, Giselle, and here I am, I'm giving you the flashes. One other thing I wanted to mention to you today, there's a kind of a news flash too, but a horrific one, is the FDA. God bless the FDA. The FDA has asked the manufacturers of Vyvanse. Vyvanse is nothing more than dextroamphetamine. It's what we used to call dexedrine. That's all it is. It's dextroamphetamine. They make it long-acting by latching something else onto it that's inactive, basically. And they now have gone, the FDA, to them and said, we want you to study the effects of this drug on toddlers. The company didn't ask the FDA. The FDA has to come. And where did they come up with this? Well, the horrific news came out recently that we have 10,000 toddlers are off-label and, I think, unethically, illegally, fraudulently treating little children with drugs like Vyvanse, with drugs for ADHD. Toddlers, little ones. And the FDA looks at that, and instead of saying, like any moral organization would, stop it, don't do it, the FDA is saying, let's learn more about it. Let's study it. Well, we've already studied the effects of these drugs on 2 and 3 year olds, starting way back in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And it's a disaster to give these drugs to little children. They get overwhelmed with depression and lassitude and apathy and anxiety. There's tons of studies. I review them in a number of my books, including brain disabling treatments and psychiatry, and also in talking back to Ritalin, and also the Ritalin Fact book. I talk about these early studies, which really made sane physicians absolutely never give these drugs to infants and tiny children. And so the FDA now, by inviting this company, which didn't even want it because they're concerned that too much of their revenue is in this one drug, inviting this company, pressuring this company to do the studies to cover up that they won't stand up and say, stop doing this. No, they're going to study it. That's where the devil always goes. Electroshock, study it. Although, of course, the shock people are trying to keep the FDA from even studying it. But that's real extreme. Well, you can see my dander is up. My wonderful guest, Greg Smith, has no idea that I don't usually start with such outrage and energy. Greg, are you there?
Yes, I am, and I am listening, and I love it.
Well, I love Greg Smith. Greg is an anesthesiologist. His original training is in anesthesiology, and he's also become a filmmaker, and he is the filmmaker of American Addict, a film that has done extremely well and continues to do well, and is available off of all the places you can get films, right?
Yeah, it's everywhere. It's Netflix right now. It's Amazon. You can pretty much see it everywhere right now.
And I had the honor of being filmed for American Addict. And when they decided to do the sequel, Greg did me the honor again of having me come back as one of the few people coming back. And I've been filmed for the sequel. He's going to tell you about that. He's also going to talk with us about his clinics. He has clinics that take people off of prescribed medication. I've never applauded before in front of my mic. I have no idea how that's going to work out. I tell you, this stuff about the children just gave me new energy. I think I should bring it to all of my shows. And he'll tell you about his clinics. He's got a lot of interesting ideas on politics. He is, as I said, an MD. He's a graduate of Indiana University in chemistry and biology and Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, the med school, and that's a hotbed of biological psychiatry.
Yes.
And anesthesiology at SUNY, State University of New York in Brooklyn. And he's certified in both anesthesiology and interventional pain management. Greg, welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Well, you know what, Peter, I appreciate you having me on. As you were great in the first movie and probably even better in the second one, as you'll see. And these are important topics. And when I hear you talk about little children, I mean, I have a 7-year-old son myself, and when I hear about toddlers and the marketing to toddlers for anxiety disorders and things like this makes me sick to my stomach, and this really fuels me to do what I'm doing, because we know that the prescription drug problems is a tremendous epidemic in this country, but it's a special problem when you start drugging small innocent children. And I don't know who's worse in this situation. There's so many culprits, the parents, the people, the doctors that are prescribing it, the parents that let it happen. But all I know is the children are innocent, and that has to stop.
Oh, yeah. It's evil. In my mind, I'm thinking, how do I write a blog, The Evil FDA? I mean, it just so shows its colors.
Yeah.
In this regard, when it goes ahead and says, we've got this serious problem of drugging of children, let's study it. We'll give you the power to do it. We'll invite you to give these drugs to children, instead of saying to America's doctors, stop this off-label use. Stop it.
Right. Well, you know, this is an extreme example of basically naked capitalism in the medical system. So in other words, we always have this situation going on where profits trump the public health. And it's really up to people educating themselves and becoming aware and not simply blindly trusting the physician or the medical system, because often, as you know, the physicians are pawns themselves. They're basically prescribing and providing treatments that they were taught in medical school and residency. And I was one of those people for years that did the conventional things, because we were taught that in medical school, that everything else is quackery. Nutrition is quackery. Chiropractic is quackery. Holistic, any kind of complementary medicine is quackery. And nothing could be further from the truth. And so for me, it was a process of unlearning some of the things that I had learned, and then learning the complementary and alternative things, and really trying to come up with an integrative approach where you have the best of all worlds. And that's where you can get people better. But the bottom line is that I don't believe that our government or this country is really serious about the healthcare problem in general, because there's always a focus on pills for the diseases or problems instead of preventing the diseases and the problems in the first place. We could wipe out tremendous debt. Everyone could have insurance. We could solve this problem very quickly if we focused on getting people healthy, you know, where we're talking about preventive diseases like high blood pressure and diabetes and obesity. If that was controlled, the people stopped eating fast food for a year. I mean, we'd have billions of dollars put back in the system. So I guess to bring this back to the little kids, it's just the extreme example of what's being done to everybody else. But now they're trying to open up even newer markets by going to these toddlers that are completely defenseless. And it is deplorable.
It is deplorable. You know, we've talked only a very little bit about politics during when we got together. I tend to be a free marketeer, but I agree with you in a way that this is the result of unbridled capitalism and profit motive, but not quite. This is government collusion. This is fascism. This is the FDA using its power to support the drug companies and advance their agendas of ever wider drugging, including little children. So it's to me, it's more complicated in terms of how we have not just the capitalism on the one hand, but actually kind of a fascism, not quite crony capitalism, but the cooperation, the synergistic work of the supposed monitoring agency with the people it's monitoring to make things come out even better for the drug companies. How will we look at it?
You're right.
An outrageous disaster.
You're right. And again, at the root of that too is more money, because the drug companies, as we both know, give an incredible amount of money, somewhere to the tune of $300 to $400 million, I think, a year, to the FDA to oversee the drugs being approved onto the market. And that's a ridiculous conflict of interest, obviously. So no one in private business would ever go for that, but our government is doing that. And the problem is the FDA is supposed to be protecting people, but when there's money at stake like this, when these drugs can take upwards to $1 billion just to get a single drug to market, there's so much money at play here that there's tremendous pressure on the FDA, who's being supported by these same drug companies, to get these drugs on the market and to support these drug companies in their endeavors. So it is a bad, bad situation. But the good news, I think, here is that the people always have the power to stop this, because if you go to your physician and ask for alternatives, if they don't have alternatives, you go to naturopaths or nutritionists or doctors that practice an integrative approach or stay away from a pharmaceutical approach at least, then the market has to respond, because if no one's getting the drugs or taking the drugs, they will start to fall in line, because they always follow the money. But you're right. It, when you look at this, it's so sinister that you start to wonder, you know, are we in the United States or not? Sometimes it's really, really that bad.
Oh, it really is getting terrible. The, you know, just to, you know all about this, but just to tell my audience about some of this issue around the children, the FDA has wanted these psychiatric drug companies to test the drugs on children, the reason being, well, you're giving them to children anyway. Well, that's because the damn drug companies have been pushing the drugs off-label for children. But anyhow, so the drug companies push the drugs off-label for children. Then more and more children are put on the drugs. And then the FDA says, well, now we have to study it. So they actually give advantages to the drug companies if they do studies on children. And in this case, you know, if Shire goes ahead and decides to do these children's studies, then their patent on Vyvanse will be increased over a considerable period of time as a reward for doing a study on children instead of saying, stop promoting the drugs to children.
Yeah, it's more creating more diagnoses for the pills. I saw something, I don't know if it was on Twitter or Facebook, but I retweeted it. It was a picture I thought said so much in such a, in one picture. And they basically had a classroom of children that are probably fifth grade, sixth grade, something like that. And basically you had them looking at a teacher, and one child looked like he was sort of looking out the window daydreaming. And the caption underneath said 1973, and it said kid daydreaming, right? Then they have the same picture. The caption is 2014. It says attention deficit disorder. And then they have another picture where a group of kids are on a playground, and one kid's sort of off to himself looking a little lonely, and the caption 1972 or 3 or whatever, and it says shyness. And then the other same picture, 2014, it's a social anxiety disorder or affective disorder. So it basically shows us how we've created these diagnoses for problems that really aren't problems. They're just people being normal. Sometimes people or children are shy and adults are shy. Sometimes you feel a little bit timid or anxious. It doesn't mean that you need to have a drug for that. So this is what I think is happening a lot in the pharmaceutical industry is, and when you see these commercials where they create a constellation of symptoms that basically everybody has had at one point in their life, because they read off if you've ever coughed, have you ever been sad, have you ever been, and then if they get to the end of this laundry list of symptoms, well then maybe you have X or maybe you have this disorder, and but don't worry, we have a pill for it. And that's what seems to be going on more and more and more and more. And as we've even said in the first film, we're only one of two industrialized countries that even allow direct marketing to customers or to people on television and print and et cetera, because all the other countries have realized that this is not a good idea. But here, they are one of the biggest advertisers in the media.
Yeah, and it's that advertising that really changed the media. Once the drug companies could advertise direct to the public, the big TV news shows stopped covering people like myself who were critics of the drugs. So I used to, in the 80s and 90s, get on ABC Evening News or other shows like that much more frequently than now, because of this power of the advertising.
You're right. I mean, it's happened to me also. I mean, I've had been booked on some national shows before, and at the last minute, I think a producer probably had looked and seen in the interview I did on RT or did on Al Jazeera or some more alternative type media, and they're like, we have one of our biggest sponsors is one of the drug companies, so we're not going to have them on. And it's a shame. And again, this is the problem, is that the general public doesn't get a chance to hear things like we're speaking of today, because the mainstream media is very controlled. The message is very controlled, and you see the consolidation of the media corporations. And I read something a couple weeks ago that was pretty shocking, that if you look back into the late 70s, early 80s, there was something like around 60 major corporations that controlled media in terms of newspaper, radio, TV, etc. Now there's only six, and one of those six is getting ready to, the merger that's getting ready just to happen between Time Warner and Comcast will make it five. So these radio, TV show, or TV networks, films, all these conglomerations are coming together to one to have a unified message, and it's getting harder and harder for people really to hear anything except for that message. And thank God that we still have the internet and things like this to get out this message, because otherwise people would completely have basically propaganda being told to them through the media, since there's such a tight control on it at this point in time.
Right on. I just noticed in your biography that you've published 12 books. What kind of books have you been writing? I didn't know that. And compare writing books to doing films.
The books that I've done were more medical based. I used to write a lot of books for helping residents and medical students pass the board. I did pretty well on medical boards, so I used to write books for that. The book that I'm finishing right now is a book that goes with the movie. It's called American Addict: How Doctors Have Created a Generation of Drug Addicts. And although it does share the title of American Addict, it's very, very different from the film. And I'm also really trying to emphasize some good news, because all this is gloom and doom and it's horrible. And so I always ask myself, and I ask other people, two questions, and that is, A, what are we going to do about it? And B, what most people want to know is, what can they do about it? Because most people aren't in a position to necessarily know or have the time or to be as aware of some of the things that you and I are, because we're physicians and we've been doing this for a long time. The average person may not know what they can do, but there's a lot they can do to sort of reverse this horrific trend. And so that's really the focus of a lot of what I'm writing right now. And it's also going to be in American Addict 2. We're really going to try to end this film on an up note, because, you know, let's face it, American Addict is a sobering film. It is a little bit depressing, because most people didn't know a lot of the information that's in that film. And most people don't realize what's being done to them instead of what's being done for them. And we have to turn this cycle around. And you know, this is why I'm so impressed with you, Peter. I'm not, you know, I'm just telling you the truth. I mean, the work that you've done, the things you've written and you've spoken out, I think has saved and helped so many people, and really helped educate me in the ways your approach to, you know, psychotropic drugs and all that was not my specialty. So I'm very happy that I came in contact with you, because it really changed my mind on that kind of stuff. But the problem is that the average person's not getting the message, and that's the challenge, is getting this message out to the average person so things can change.
Well, thank you for that. I want to tell people that American Addict, the title is interestingly misleading, because it's not much about addiction drugs. It's mostly about psychiatric drugs. Is that fair to say?
Well, it's about habit-forming drugs, period. And we're talking about, you know, psychotropic drugs. We're talking about sleeping pills, narcotics, anti-anxieties like Xanax and Valium, and they all have different ways of, you know, addicting people. I mean, we think of addiction, and most people think of narcotics or alcohol and street drugs, but it's really the prescription pills that are reaping the havoc on the population. It dwarfs the illegal drug trade and illegal drug problem. And obviously, I'm not saying that the illegal drug problem is not a problem, but the prescription drug problem is so much bigger, and a lot of people don't realize that. The money is bigger, the corruption is bigger, and the amount of people dying is a lot more than from illicit drugs.
American Addict, folks, is a very, very good film. I don't usually promote things directly like that on the show, but it's a very good film. And you're calling the second one American Addict Act 2?
We're calling it American Addict 2, The Big Lie. And, you know, they have to watch the movie to see what the big lie is. But
when is it coming out?
We have a scheduled release date of October 1st. So, this is mid-June, so we have 4 or 5 months or so to go. But it's going to be fantastic. It starts a little bit similar to the first one, but it's very different after that. And as you know, Sasha Nezef, the director, his first documentary was American Addict, so he comes from theatrical narrative film. So and that's on purpose because we want the film to look cinematic, to be entertaining, but at the same time extremely informative. So not just a, you know, talking heads, boring type documentary, but something that people actually will enjoy watching and that could really help change their life.
Well, American Addict is just like that, and it's going to be very exciting to see the sequel. We've got about 5 minutes before we go to break. Do you want to start a conversation about the work you're doing with your clinics?
Well, sure, I can talk about it a little bit, and as I've always said, I try to talk as little as much as I can, or a little about what I personally do, because my intention when I'm on any kind of a program is to try and educate and help people. And I don't ever want people to think we're trying to recruit patients or anything like that, but I do think that what we're doing is different, it's special, it's getting people better, and most importantly, not just getting people off prescription drugs, but stopping them from relapsing, because I think that rehab or detox in this country is failing dramatically because there's such an emphasis on just getting people off the drugs and not looking at why they're doing the drugs in the first place. And we're really talking, and this is a big subject, it's probably going to bleed over to the next segment, but we're really talking
I don't want you to rush. We're going to definitely go over into the next segment about this. So don't rush at all. You got a couple more minutes to talk about it.
Okay. Well, it's really, we're talking genetics because there's predispositions that we can now test. We're talking about brain chemistry. When someone's brain chemistry is off, similar to an insulin-dependent diabetic not having enough insulin, people do things that they would not normally do. It's people's environment. Where they live, how they live, the people that's around them. There's different things that cause a person to abuse a substance, whether it's alcohol or a prescription drug like OxyContin or cocaine. There's a reason. So if you don't address all those reasons, the psychological aspects, the brain chemistry aspects, and take in consideration the genetics in a person, the failure rate is extremely high. And that's what we see in the vast majority of programs in this country, is that they may be somewhat successful early on getting people off the drugs, but they relapse at a high rate. And I tell people all the time, if you're diagnosed with some horrific cancer or some horrific diagnosis, you don't want to be told that relapse is part of recovery. You want to be told that we're going to get it out of your body, we're going to cure you, and you're going to go on with your life. And that's the way I approach people that have a substance abuse problem. We want to get them right the first time, and unless they don't want to stay clean, they can stay clean forever if they do the things that's necessary to keep their brain chemistry in balance and if they control their environment. And it sounds simple, and it is simple, but it's not always easy to do.
And you're increasingly helping people come off psych drugs, not just pain meds.
Yeah, and you know, when we met up last, so I talked to you a little bit about this because I wanted to get some of your insight and advice about that. But I noticed that around 2010 or 11, we started seeing people come off some other drugs just by coincidence, or sort of when we were getting them off their prescription narcotic, all of a sudden they didn't need their Ambien to sleep, or they felt like they weren't depressed anymore, so they didn't need the Zoloft or the Prozac. So I started developing ways to actually, on purpose, get people off these things. And again, a lot of it's environment and psychotherapy type approaches and medical hypnotherapy and things like that. And at the same time, getting people off these psych drugs is a delicate thing, because as you know, once you're on them and people stop them, they can become wildly depressed and even suicidal coming off of them, just like when they're going on them, because it just screws up a person's normal brain chemistry, which obviously I don't have to tell you about that, but people don't know how to get off these drugs. And you see doctors will write a drug like a Prozac or a Paxil or whatever, and problem solved. They'll be on the drug for the rest of their life if they don't try and get off of it, because they just keep refilling the prescription.
Let's go to break. We're talking with Greg Smith from Los Angeles. That's where your clinics are, right? Your clinic?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Greg Smith, MD, as you can tell, a man that is doing wonderful things in the world. And we'll talk more about Greg and his work when we come back. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. And I have on a person I hope that I will get to be better and better friends with. His name is Greg Smith. He's a physician, pain management, I guess is a one loose term about how he was trained, anesthesiology. He's written lots of books, and but most important from my viewpoint, a very good film called American Addict that I was in, and I'm going to be in the sequel, American Addict 2, The Big Lie, which comes out in early October. And he also has an approach to helping people come off of psychoactive substances, and we're going to continue with that conversation. Why don't you just pick up on that, Greg? Anything else you want to do?
Sure. Before we went to break, we were just sort of talking about the different aspects of addiction that are often overlooked, and I was really sort of alluding to the failure of treatment in this country right now for people with the substance abuse, because the emphasis is often talk therapy only, or just a quick medical detox, and we have people that relapse over and over and over again. Now, if we take out the subset of people that really want to do the drugs, because there are people that just want to get high and there's not much you can do about that until they're ready to really stop. But if you look at DNA testing on people, and you can really see drug sensitivities, and you can also look at predisposition for a person to have a substance abuse. It's not a crystal ball, but it gives you more information. And then when you look at someone's brain chemistry, which is usually very unbalanced, very similar to the way that people would talk about antidepressants, raising serotonin and all that, a little bit different subject, but same type of thing where brain chemistry is out of balance that can go in to make people crave a certain drug or alcohol. And then we have a person's environment. There's a lot of different factors that cause a person to abuse any substance. It's not one or two. It's a lot of different factors. So I guess the point we're making here with treatment, and I do something called the NESP program, N-E-S-P. It's an acronym. It stands for nutritional, emotional, social, financial, physical, psychological, what I call the six aspects of the chronic pain and addiction experience. When you look at all these different factors and treat them, then your success rate goes very high, and then you have a situation where people are not relapsing because they're in balance. And usually you can achieve this with mostly natural things. You don't have to give them a bunch of medications to keep them in balance. You can give them good nutrition, nutraceuticals. Things are actually good for people to keep them in balance. But the bigger question, I think, Peter, from all of this is that why are people becoming addicted in the first place? It's an epidemic. We had the CDC, I believe, or may have been the NIH, but it came out about a year ago talking about 70% of the population is taking at least one prescription drug, 50% of the population is taking two or more. That's an incredible number, especially when you compare it to 30 or 40 years ago. And I think that it is the mentality that our medical system and our society has gone in parallel, where there is people want instant gratification, and they believe what they're told in the media. And what they're told in the media is that no matter what your problem is, there's a pill for it. If you can't sleep, there's a pill. If you're sad, there's a pill. If you're overweight, there's a pill. If you're having sexual or erectile dysfunction, there's a pill. The list goes on and on and on. And so this is how people end up being on multiple medications. And even though some of those medications aren't inherently addicting, they become addicting in the sense from a psychological standpoint. A very good illustration is the erectile dysfunction drugs. I mean, they work on a lot of men, but the problem is that then the man feels like that he can't perform without that drug. And so that even though it's not addicting from maybe a chemical standpoint, it is from a psychological standpoint. And this is a great situation for the pharmaceutical companies because it drives their profits through the roof. And in fact, when you examine their profits, their profit margin is one of the highest. I think it's in the top three highest margins of any of all industry. They make so much of their money turns into pure profit. It's really insane at this point. And there seems to be no end point to this because people, again, get most of their information from television, mainstream media, and they keep saying, well, I got to keep working, got to pay the bills, so I need to take this medication to sleep, I need to take this medication to do this, you know, to keep my blood pressure down, and et cetera, et cetera. If we really step back, and if we're really serious in this country about helping people and containing health care costs and making sure everyone is insured, if there was a complete focus on giving people either free or very inexpensive different kind of supplementation that they need for the imbalances they have from the poor nutrition and things like that, a lot of our medical problems would go away within a matter of months to years, things like obesity and all the problems that are associated with that. So I guess what I'm trying to say here is that the best way to prevent addiction or to treat addiction in these areas is to stop it from happening in the first place, because many people are becoming addicted to prescription drugs when they don't even need to be on them in the first place, and that has to do especially in the area of chronic pain.
You know from our chatting before, and you know my work so well, that I'm skeptical about what we can know about brain chemistry or about genetics. Do you want to talk a little more about that? About, what does it mean that you can find a genetic marker or something that relates to addiction or to its treatment? What kind of chemicals can you test? How do you do it?
Right.
You don't have to go into it in any depth, but if you feel like spending a couple of minutes on it, that would be useful.
Yeah, it's important, and I know when we talked in person, you had said that, and it's new. This is new stuff. I mean, but the test that I use in particular, I do a test that the main one for addiction, that is a 12-gene test. And what that means is that our mom and her dad gave us a gene to just like for eye color, but we also get a gene for a dopamine receptor or serotonin receptor. So those are what I look at. I look at the genes that are expressed as the receptors in our nervous system. So let's take something like serotonin again, because this is, most people are familiar with this because this is what's been put out in the media for years of why people are depressed, because they have a serotonin imbalance, and these drugs will drive up your serotonin and you'll feel happy. Obviously not that simple, but that's what people have been told, so people are familiar with that. We have multiple subclasses of serotonin receptors in our nervous system or in our brain. If they are genetically defective, and we can do a test to show that if they're what's called homozygous mutant or heterozygous mutant, which simply means that homozygous means that both mom and dad gave you a bad gene for that receptor, and heterozygous means that maybe mom gave you a good one and dad gave you a bad one, or vice versa. So if we look at a person that has receptor problems with dopamine and serotonin and norepinephrine, on and on, these people are predisposed to certain substances such as like methamphetamine because they don't have normal levels of dopamine or things that make them feel good. So in order to make themselves feel good, they have to do drugs that completely blast up their brain chemistry or the dopamine reward system, like a methamphetamine addict, just to feel normal. So the key here is, a lot of times people with a substance abuse, the joy of doing it for just getting high is long gone. They're usually doing it when time has elapsed for two reasons. One, to prevent withdrawals or being what's called dope sick, or two, to just try and feel normal. And that's what the DNA can help you show, that if they have all kinds of receptor problems, this is a good indication that their brain chemistry is not normal, and you can sort of try and attack that. So, for instance, if I want to try and give them more dopamine, you could, you know, there are people who give Abilify. I'm not a fan of that. That's another drug. But you can also give them L-tyrosine, which will convert into dopamine in their nervous system, and try increase their dopamine naturally instead of giving them yet another drug. So this is where I think DNA testing is becoming better and better, and I believe that in another 10 years, 5 to 10 years, it's going to be a standard, because it really takes a lot of the guesswork out of medications, out of prescribing. And Peter, I know I'm talking a lot, but I want to expand on that, because and this is a huge amount of money that the drug companies get because of bad prescriptions, and here's what I mean. So another DNA test that I run that's for drug sensitivities, and very similar to a person that has a lactose intolerance for milk, and they because they're missing the enzyme lactase, or they have a defective enzyme lactase, you can have missing or defective enzymes for metabolizing drugs. And I'm talking about anti-inflammatories like Motrin, sleeping pills, things like Lyrica or Neurontin, narcotics, all kinds of pills. So when we do these tests on people, and you can find out they metabolize a drug too fast, too slow, or they often have no enzyme for the drug at all. And this explains why so many people have side effects from the drugs that they're given or don't tolerate it. And this is something that the drug companies don't want you to know, because guess what? They like the fact that doctors make mistakes with giving medication, because that drug is still filled and paid for. Perfect example is if you come to a doctor's office and you have an infection and they give you an antibiotic and you fill it and you go home and you take one pill and it makes you throw up, you come back to the doctor and say, hey, I'm allergic, I need another drug. And they give you another drug, but that first bottle was filled and paid for, and the pharmaceutical company made their money. So millions and millions of dollars, this is something that's not talked about a lot, but millions, tens of millions of dollars are made every year from mistakes, basically, because doctors, basically, when they prescribe, it's an educated guess when you really think about it, without using DNA testing. So that's why I'm such a fan of it.
You know, a couple of thoughts. One, that is so spot on, because we now have all kinds of DNA testing we could do to determine whether or not somebody can be able to safely metabolize a variety of psychiatric drugs, and in particular the antidepressants. And if the person's a poor metabolizer, doesn't have the proper fill of enzymes to get the drug out of the system, to basically destroy it and excrete it, that people will get excessive reactions. So you think you're taking 20 milligrams of Prozac, but the equivalent of your blood level is 40 or 60.
Mm-hmm.
And I had not thought about what you just said. That's a new thought, that, and I'm sure you're right, that what happens is that if they were to do that test, then people just wouldn't take the drug at all, and they'd much rather have the test be that you get really sick, because then you still bought the bottle. I think that's absolutely true, because the drug companies have absolutely not publicized this scientific reality, and as a result, it's very expensive to get these tests. They could be very much cheaper if they were done in a large scale, and people don't know about them, and doctors don't even think about them. You mentioned before Abilify. Abilify, of course, is a dopamine blocker, and you're giving drugs that you're hoping are going to enhance dopamine.
Correct.
We do have drugs that stimulate dopamine. We use them in Parkinsonism, and they have a tendency to make people very disturbed because these prescription drugs jack things up in a very bad way. But you're giving precursors, I guess, to dopamine and thinking that maybe that's going to improve the balance or improve the production of dopamine.
And what we see from a clinical standpoint, and there's not a lot of data, in terms of saying, well, it's the blood level of their dopamine levels and all this, but from a clinical standpoint, the results are pretty amazing when you see people there improve. And it's not just giving them tyrosine, it's the whole picture. When you take in consideration the medications that if you have to give them medication, not giving them medication is going to make them sick, or if they're a slow metabolizer, as you just said, it increases their ability to have a functional overdose at a normal dose and have side effects or have even worse problems. But when you do all of these things, this is where you can get people better on a more permanent basis instead of just detoxing them. Because rehab and detox and all the terms, it's a wide range of service that comes under those titles. And all too often, you're not getting really a full program. I mean, you have places that it's basically 12-step and all talk therapy, and you have places that they'll just take you in and put you in a situation to detox you in a day or two medically and monitor you and then send you off on your way. These are not situations that are going to have an effect that's a positive effect for a long term. I mean, 12-step program is a very good support system, especially when people don't have a good social support system, family or whatever. But I feel like that my personal view is that it's not enough for most people. And I'm not bashing 12-step programs because I've been accused of that in the past. I'm just simply stating the truth. In their own literature, they have about a 90% relapse rate, which is incredibly high. I mean, again, if I'm trying to get rid of a problem, I don't want to go in it knowing that 9 out of 10 people are going to return with the same problem. So it's not saying that the 12-step programs can be effective. It's just that there needs to be more. And I think when you look at all these aspects, you can really get people better and most importantly, better on a more permanent basis.
Do you want to talk a little bit about your actual method, how long people stay with you? Well, we can go on and talk more broadly about politics, but if you'd like to, I'm happy to invite you to talk about a little bit more about what you do. It's so unusual. We have so few places people can go for an alternative to get off, especially psych drugs, unless you're a horrible benzo addict and that's recognized by your doctor, then you go to rehab like an alcohol ward. I mean, it's really hard. Do you want to talk a little bit more about your program?
Sure. I mean, it's the way it's a very customized situation. I mean, there's a few standard things that we do. And first of all, the patients are screened. I mean, we have to make sure that this is someone that really wants to get better. And I can't emphasize that more. There is no cure. There is no program that's successful for a person that still wants to do the drug for whatever reason, whether they have so much fear and they're institutionalized, as I say, in their chronic pain, for instance, where they're so convinced that without the drug they have no chance of being out of pain and you can't convince them otherwise, that's a person that's not going to do well. And then for a recreational user, if they're still in the stage where they're having a good time, you can't reach a person like that. And that's one reason I really don't do court-ordered patients usually either, because normally they're being forced or coerced to do a program to avoid jail or something. So we really want to get people that have reached that point where they know they have to get out of this or they're going to die. And when you have a person in that position, then the chances go even higher they're going to get better and stay better. And really the beginning of it is just an IV protocol where we basically give them a series of different things intravenously for about 6 to 8 hours a day for 3 days in a row. That's sort of the medical part of detox. And I do use buprenorphine, which is also known as Suboxone or Subutex in some of the patients, but I don't use that. I usually use a compounded version by a pharmacy that I have make it, because I just think it works better. and also in people that have pain, it actually can be effective for pain. So really there's two different paths. You have the patient that's in chronic pain that's more dependent and not so much addicted, but dependent on narcotics and other drugs, sleeping pills, etc., and then you have the recreational user. So they go down sort of a different path after those first 3 days that we're basically trying to clear them out and make their liver and bile system and all that empty and get hydrate them and get them nutrition and all that, because the person that's in chronic pain, the emphasis is keeping them their pain under control, because if their pain's not under control, they're going to go back and take the narcotics. And the truly addicted, from a recreational standpoint, there's a lot more, usually, a lot more psychological issues at play, and so we have to work on that a little bit harder for those patients, again, without giving them more pharmacology. We're not giving them antidepressants and things like that. We're getting them off of those. So that's sort of in a very nutshell, because there's a lot more to it, but that's sort of what we do here to make people better.
What about follow-up? Because you've talked about the need for something.
What about which one?
Follow-up.
Oh, follow-up. Well, the follow-up is there's always follow-up, and it depends on the patient. So we have patients that are doing so well after they're done that we see them sparingly, and there's other people that they have certain issues that are more pressing that they need to take care of. So, for example, a good one is the psychological aspect. As you know, psychological issues can take a long time to resolve. That could be whether a person's just having some cognitive behavioral therapy or psychotherapy or medical hypnotherapy, but again, that can be done on an ongoing basis outpatient, and that could go on for weeks, months, or even longer. It just depends on the patient. But we have other people that do this or are here for 2 or 3 weeks, and they're good to go, and they hardly have to do anything. And we follow these people. We're actually in the process right now of doing a 9-year follow-up study. We have a 5-year follow-up study that was done in 2010, and that study showed about an 85% success rate, with success being defined that they were still off narcotics, and this is 5 years out. They had reduced pain scores and better activity of daily living scores, and this is mainly with the pain patients, but the bottom line is they were still off their narcotics. Now, in the new study, we're also going to track some of the other things like antidepressants, are they still off sleeping pills, et cetera. So it'll be a little bit more comprehensive when we're done with that one.
I hope you can get these published in some form. It'd be a real contribution.
Well, we had posters at the American Pain Society meeting last year, a couple of them, and I'm pretty sure we can get this the outcome studies published, but you're right, that would help a lot.
Yeah, it would. We've got about 3 minutes left. It's really great to have you on the show. You know, folks, the film is really good. American Addict is a really good film. As you know, I'm also, my listening folks, I'm also a fan of Generation RX. If you watch those two films, if you haven't seen one of them, get the other. If you haven't seen any of them, get them both. If you've seen them both, tell other people about them. How's that for clever talk? I just got over-energized by the FDA wanting to test drugs on toddlers. I hope there's some form of retribution for that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Spiritual retribution. But these are both really good films, and they just are a marvelous way to communicate with other people and to share them with other people and to get the word out. We've got about, I don't know, maybe a minute and a half left. Greg Smith, do you have any summary words for folks?
Well, I just want to say that it's programs like yours that are going to help spread that message, and I do believe that the answer is going to have to come, grassroots is going to have to come from the people, and people making better decisions and more informed decisions about their own health and not get victimized by a medical system that is more money-driven at this point than health-driven. And I think if people keep that in mind, things can change dramatically. And like you said, whether it's American Addict or Generation RX, and there's other films and books and things like this, people need to take the time, turn the TV off for a few hours, because people watch way too much TV, and replace that with reading books, watching documentaries that can really change their life, and then tell other people about it.
A perfect ending, right with the music. My guest, Greg Smith, MD. He's in Los Angeles. You can Google him and find him easily in that manner. Greg, thank you very, very much for being on.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. I really appreciate it.